Occupied Territory with Mike Fader, Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Occupied Territory, and I'm Mike Fader. Stay tuned for Revolution Radio here. Something in the air today. There's something in the air. We will be taking calls later if you like to give us a call. The number here is 888-874-4888, and you can give us a tweet at PRN, at PRN underscore radio, PRN underscore radio. And if you want to check some of the archives for our show, go to the Occupied, go to PRN.fm and go to Occupied Territory, and you can check out the archives. And from there, you can get onto our Facebook page, and you can post anything, any opinions, any links, videos, any comments about the shows that you see there, and please do that. We we may hear later from somebody from Occupy Albany. I don't know. It's hard to set these things up, and everybody's sort of at a last-minute crisis mode, because tomorrow up at Occupy Albany, and I've spoken to them before on the air, they have a permit which was extended by the city for quite some time, but it's up tomorrow. So they may be facing the same sort of eviction, hopefully not the same sort of violent eviction that occurred in many other places. And if we do hear from them, it would be around 20 minutes to 2, something like that, roughly, if we do hear from them. And I will be reporting various other things. So as we can see, the Occupy movement has been evicted from a lot of places. It's still active in a lot of places. There are places. I got this notice from Occupy Nashville. And preventing foreclosures or occupying houses that may be foreclosed or that are abandoned is something that Occupy is doing across the country. And Occupy Nashville sent me something today saying that they plan to be at a courthouse at 9:30 a.m. down in Nashville. And they mention a woman named Mrs. Bailey, Mrs. Helen Bailey, and to try to help her out of her foreclosure situation. They're picking on various situations where people are about literally to be thrown out by sheriffs and marshals and the police, and banks have foreclosed. Chase Bank, of course, which owns a whole lot of mortgages and is foreclosing all over the country. Her name is Helen Bailey, and she's 78 years old, has spent the last 19 of those years in a home which Chase Bank is now foreclosing on. The sale is scheduled to happen tomorrow. The house would be resold, theoretically. And Wednesday, December 21st, that's today. So they'll be there today, and I'll probably find out later what happened. Her attorney is doing everything he can to get the sale postponed, but as of this afternoon, we're unsure if Chase will comply, and they're issuing a call down there in Nashville. So there are plenty of places still extant, you know, occupy locations. At one point we should be clear on, it says here, if Chase had been willing to make a $9,000 principal reduction several months ago, the home would not currently be in foreclosure. Ms. Bailey's attorney had a viable plan that required the $9,000 reduction. In the same quarter that Chase denied his proposal to let this woman stay in her house, she's 78 and would have just needed a $9,000 principal reduction, in the same quarter that they have foreclosed, or they might foreclose on her, and they foreclose on God knows how many thousands of other people, and just throw them out, who knows where they stay, and it's wintertime. They reported $4.26 billion in profits, Chase. $4.26 billion. So this is what's going on now. So the Occupy movement is in transition, obviously. A lot of people are maintaining these occupations, and a lot of people are retreating. Sometimes retreat is necessary in any battle, and this is a long-term battle. This is not, as we may find out later when we discuss this, this is not a short-term revolution. What happened in Tahrir Square, and what is continuing to happen there now, of course, now the military inevitably is the are the ones who are really in power all the time, and they're the ones who are shooting people and treating, dragging women through the street. But that was started, you know, sometime in the late winter, early spring, and came straight through for, several months, and was relentless, 24 hours a day, an occupation. People stayed in that square in the tens of thousands, and finally the government was overthrown. Well, that is to say, the face of the government was overthrown. Obviously, it was always clear. If the military had stepped in on the side of Mubarak, there would still be a Mubarak dictatorship. But the military chose to let him go. It was too much of an embarrassment for them. They were getting billions of dollars every year from the United States government, and the United States government were threatening them with not updating their weapon systems, not giving them new weapons or parts, and not pouring money into their military. The military runs Egypt. The military owns vast companies. The military is a corporate state all by itself. So they're the bosses. They're in charge. And they have the guns, they have the weapons, and they have the soldiers. And you can see what they're doing. So now the naked face, the false face, was ripped off. That was Mubarak. They tossed him overboard because he was causing them too much embarrassment. So now the naked face, the naked, grotesque face of the power, of the real power in Egypt, is face-to-face with their own people. And what will happen now, who knows? The way they treated women the other day was extraordinary. In fact, yesterday, thousands and thousands, for the first time, I think it's close to 100 years, when women poured out in the street with men to protest British colonial rule in 1919, thousands of women came out yesterday. Thousands of Arab Muslim women poured out in the streets yesterday and demanded that the military cede power, that the military apologize for what they did, that the military institute reforms instantly. And, well, good luck to them. But the fact that women poured out on the street like that, it's extraordinary. And you see these things happening. You see these things happening all over the world. In China, we've got a town that's been occupied now, and protesters have forbidden to let government authorities in. They blocked a bridge leading into the town. People in the world are waking up, but what are they face-to-face with? An international kind of police and military, dictatorship, corporate police dictatorship. So this is what's going on. And the same thing in this country. When this new bill that the Senate passed overwhelmingly and the House approved, naturally, to use the military to detain indefinitely, to arrest and detain indefinitely American citizens who may be suspected of terrorism, that will be that. You can be sure of that. So we'll be joining every other country, Russia, China, Egypt, in just having the naked face of power show itself. Do we have our guest on? Okay. Today we're going to talk to Les Leopold. Are you there?
I'm here.
You're there? Well, I'm here, so that makes two of us. All right. Les Leopold is with us, and I've talked to Les frequently about various things having to do with what eventually caused the Occupy movement to erupt, and which is the corporate corruption and the corporate devastation of the American political system and economy. And Les Leopold is the executive director of the Labor Institute and Public Health Institute in New York, and author of The Looting of America: How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. So, Les recently wrote an article, which I read on Alternate, about, what the Occupy movement is obviously changing shape, and as they have made a lot of charges stick in the public mind, and as they have gained a kind of public recognition, you can't say power, I'm not sure which, but moral power at least, great moral weight. And obviously what's going to happen is America, any good product is going to be snapped up by a large corporation, even if it's an aggressive takeover. And what a lot of people are upset about, vis-a-vis the Occupy movement, is that the Democratic Party is showing signs of wanting to co-opt it. And when you talk about the Democratic Party, you're also talking about unions as well. So it gets a little complicated. But, the powers that be, America, for better or for worse, compromise and co-opting things, for better and for worse, is how America has been running since the beginning, without any kind of extremist revolutions. But now we have the Democratic Party making attempts to try to do this. And Les wrote a very interesting article about this. Well, the title of which, at least it was on Alternate, is Don't Occupy the Democratic Party, Four Lessons from the Populist Movement. So this has happened before in our history, where an outside, true grassroots movement, not a funded one from billionaires, but a true grassroots movement, based on the resentment and, the fact that they couldn't take it anymore of the corporate state and the oppression in the corporate state, broke out once before, especially during the Gilded Age, and it was the populist movement, and Les talks a little bit about that and relates it to what's going on now. So What do we see here currently with the Democratic Party? I know Van Jones is involved in this, and I don't know, but they seem to be very upset. Occupy really is upset about Move On, too.
Well,
it's a big subject.
Broad question.
Yeah,
a big subject. Well, let me start here by pointing out, look how far we've come. Look how far you've come. When we first started having our conversations, to say, you know, cynical was too mild a word to use, how you felt about why it was the American public wasn't outraged enough.
Right.
And now something has broken out. So let's be clear about what's broken out. The attack that's broken, it's not called Occupy Corporate America. It's not called Occupy Walmart. It's called Occupy Wall Street. And to me, that was the stroke of brilliance. That plus the 1%, 99% framework. Because what it did was it focused on what crashed the U.S. economy. You know, GM didn't take down the economy or, you know, General Electric or any of the other, you know, corporations that we have a lot of grievances against.
Mm-hmm.
This, we were taken down by Wall Street. It was a Wall Street gambling show that collapsed. And then we had to bail them out to prevent Armageddon, or so we were told. And then they got on their feet again and just started waltzing forward with their, you know, enormous paychecks as if nothing happened. And then they had the chutzpah to call on the rest of us to sacrifice to make up for the debts that they created.
Right. Austerity program for everybody, but not for them.
No, it's definitely not for them. You know, we have to pay them back, basically pay back, their bonds, make sure that, the currency doesn't get debased so that they don't lose the value of their investments. And they take no ownership whatsoever for killing 8 million jobs in a matter of months back in 2008. So America, I knew from the start, I got to say to my own horn here, I knew from the start that this was a different period. Why? Because a crazy like me got invited on radio shows all over the place, even conservative ones.
Mm.
And I also knew that in America, because of this crisis, you could go to anybody outside of the Silk Stocking District in New York. You could go door to door and talk about Wall Street, and people wouldn't slam the door in your face and call you a communist and throw you out. People were genuinely upset about this. So we entered a new period, but nobody had capitalized on that yet. And also all our attempts to highlight the income distribution problems in this country kind of fell on deaf ears. We didn't have a formulation. The labor movement said we have to resurrect the middle class, and they had this sort of sloppy version of the middle class being kind of just about everybody, but it wasn't clear who wasn't the middle class. Well, the 1%, 99% made it really clear, because there is a world of difference between those actually in the top one-tenth of 1% and the rest of the universe.
I think also, in addition to these things you're mentioning, that a lot of people, after they voted for Obama and the Democrats had a majority, in Congress, they sort of sat back and waited for good things to happen, right?
Yeah, I think there's some of that, and I think we got disappointed in a hurry, got disabused in a hurry when Obama brought in, you know, Wall Street's finest apologists, to run his economic program, and worst of all, he bought into the idea that trickle down was going to work for him. That first you were going to resurrect Wall Street, and once you resurrect Wall Street, unemployment would go down and everybody else would, benefit. One more attempt at, once we help the super rich, everyone else will be better off as well. Didn't happen. And he was hung out to dry, frankly. I think it was a wake-up call to him in August. Remember, in July, he was calling for a $4 trillion grand bargain, and he was the first Democrat ever that offered to put Social Security on the table to cut. But then in August, no new jobs were created, and he realized, he's toast. If he doesn't change his tune, he's going to be run out of office by, a tiddlywink could beat him. If unemployment stayed, if no new jobs were created for the next year. So he became a populist, but also at the very same time, Occupy Wall Street hit. So that presents us, we then get faced with a new reality. And this new reality is something that, I'm hoping we can wrap our minds around. The new reality is this. Wall Street is not going to give up its money and power without an enormous fight, without the creation of an enormous mass movement. That is a fact. I will bet anything on it that that's a reality. They've proven that even after being on both knees begging for help, we now know the picture a lot clearer as these secret documents become more well known,
mm-hmm.
that they were all about to go under. They were begging for help. They were borrowing secretly billions of dollars from the Federal Reserve.
Well, trillions, I think, right? I
mean, trillions. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, each one was borrowing tens of billions, hundreds of billions. They used it to consolidate themselves. There are fewer big banks now. They are too big to fail. They are getting, preferential treatment once again, and they have the nerve then to not show contrition, but to actually go on the offensive. Now, these banks, this institution called Wall Street, this set of institutions, is not going to give up. I'm not a person that uses this word loosely, but clearly there's a plutocracy that they're on the top of.
Right.
They're not about to give it up.
And there's no
in a mass movement.
Yeah, there's there'll never be a concession from them. It's like asking some kind of pirate to suddenly start planting flowers in his ship and sailing around.
Yeah, ain't gonna happen.
Yeah.
So how do we move forward? What happened was when Occupy Wall Street took off and sort of on the heels of the Arab Spring, there was almost a sense that we could kind of Twitter and Facebook our way into a mass movement. And you know what? I hope that happens. I really because that would be the easiest thing. That somehow after a few more email messages by spring, there'll be a million of us out on the streets in New York and Washington, and Wall Street will collapse. I don't think that's the way it's going to happen. And what disturbs me is we got into sort of the idea that Occupy Wall Street was a spectator sport. It was like we're cheering
mm-hmm.
them on,
mm-hmm.
and the rest of us, we don't know how to intervene. And that's the problematic before us. We do not have a way to intervene. There must be at least 10 to 15 million of us, Mike, people kind of like you and me,
mm-hmm.
and maybe a little less radical or a little more, although in your case, I don't know how they could be more, but a little less radical, who want to support or do something that goes after Wall Street, actually would participate in a broader movement if such a movement was formed. So the question becomes, what does the formation of such a movement look like?
That's
what I'm concentrated on.
All right, let me sort of just pause it there for a second. And we see what mass movements like that. Now, a lot of people will say, well, it's a question of extremes and everything's very simple. If you look at Egypt, you look at Syria, and you look at Tunisia, you look at all kinds of places like that, and you see what goes on in China. I mean, I'm not talking about a successful revolution, obviously, but even that town where people wouldn't even let the authorities in, right?
Mm-hmm.
You see what goes on in extreme places where there are literal military dictatorships, where the corporations and the military are the same thing, the government and the corporations and the military, basically fascist states. So they get killed. They come out on the street. The only thing they understand there very clearly is unless they put their bodies out on the street, and some of them turn into prone bodies, unfortunately, then nothing will ever change in a place like that. And I think part of the delusion we're under here, or you could call it a hope that we still might be under here, is that since we have a democracy and people vote and people run in different parties and people are allowed a form of free speech, or something that appears to be free speech, that we can still use that. If we work within that system, we'll be okay. And after all, theoretically speaking, it has worked on and off, mostly on, for a couple of hundred years. So people here are not used to pouring into the streets. And I think the last time that happened was obviously in the 60s. There were mass movements in the streets. Then you have to go back to the 30s. But in America, especially now, where people are used to so much amusement and entertainment, and they are so, like as you frequently say, they're in their own silos, a lot of them electronic silos, people do not know about general strikes in America. They don't know about sending tens of millions of people into various cities or marching on Washington. We don't do that here except for a brief couple of times that I mentioned. So then a lot of the criticism and a lot of the trouble is coming from liberals and Democrats. They are more of a problem for the Occupy movement now than I think the clear, Wall Street people are. So pardon the little speech, but I just wanted to put those thoughts out,
That's okay. I'm very used to it. Not a problem. let's start with the Dems.
Okay.
Let's start with the Dems. I think the notion that either party has the desire to tame Wall Street is a notion that I think very few people hold.
True.
I think the two parties have discredited themselves over the last generation, but really, since the Wall Street crash, it's very clear that both parties behave roughly the same when it comes to controlling Wall Street. I mean, the rhetoric from the Democrats is a little bit better, but the practice of having Wall Street's top people run American economic policy has continued unabated from Bush to Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And there are very few people in the Democratic Party who are complaining about it. There are a few, but there are very few. And I think the American public is not enthralled. This is not the generation, the New Deal generation, that was of working people that was gung-ho Democratic Party. There's still support, but it's a reluctant support. So I don't think there's a lot of hope in that area. The question is, what else can you do other than support the Democrats?
That really is the question.
What else can you do?
That is the main question.
Well, yeah, and you know who the burden falls on? It falls on people like you and me. If we're not going to Twitter and Facebook our way into it, then the people who have some capacity to encourage and build a movement have to encourage and build a movement, and they have to start taking the concrete steps. And here's where your silos come in. The silos that I'm worried about are not, the individual American who's, consumer addict and who's wearing their iPhones and lost in their bubble, computer bubble, and, stuck in that silo. I'm more worried about progressives who, over the last generation, have built very fine institutions and spend their lives keeping those institutions alive, or work in a segment of the labor movement or a segment of the various community and environmental movements, and have not recognized yet that the financial crisis of 2008 was a game changer.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we have we can be hopeful now, and I don't have to be as kind of like timid as I have been in some of the conversations we've had in the past, is because something really different has happened. When you have a global economic crisis, like the one in 1929, like some of the heavy panics in the late 1800s, when you have such enormous catastrophic economic events, the potential for building something new dramatically increases.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. We've only had a few instances of mass movements. You can count them on one hand. We had the populist movement during the Gilded Age. We had a huge labor upsurge during the 1930s. And we had a civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. And we had the 60s movements in general, women, anti-war, black liberation, that sort of all came together.
All based on the fact that people actually showed up in the street and were relentless every day.
And there was real organizational structure.
Hmm.
And that's why I took, in this article, I took people back to the populist. They had a remarkable set of institutions that created a shared experience and a shared sense of identity,
which
is what we're missing.
Maybe you could set up the situation. Obviously there's a lot of Barbara Tuchman once wrote this great book called A Distant Mirror, during the Vietnam
mm-hmm.
era, about, something that happened in the 1300s, which was exactly the same.
So
she got it all right because she was so brilliant. But the same thing here is we have a distant mirror, not so distant, but we have a mirror of what's going on here now and what could go on in terms of the people, quote unquote, with the populist movement. But set up a little bit what the situation was during that era, where we're talking about the Gilded Age, basically. But
sure. There was still a majority of America living on small farms. And what had happened after, during a brief period during the Civil War, to finance it, we had gone onto a pay currency, which had actually made times good for farmers because the money supply was expanding and there was a way for them to, prices went up for farm goods and life was getting better. But after the Civil War, there was a major piece of control exerted by Wall Street that demanded that we go back to the gold standard to make sure that their debts would be repaid at par value and not through this paper currency. So we went back to the to gold, and the money supply got fixed. As the population grew, it actually meant that the money supply was shrinking. And farm prices got tremendously crushed, and the farmers became destitute. And in order for them to survive, they had to basically pledge their crops with a series of monopolies. The local store owner, there was usually one main store owner, which they called the man, by the way. The term the man, working for the man, came up at that point. And they had to pledge their crops to get supplies to survive for the winter, and to make it to the next planting season. And, you know, they were then losing their farms, and they were paying enormous interest rates, 40-50%, to secure these loans. So farmers started to meet together, actually starting in Texas, and they set up a farmers alliance, and they started to make co-ops. And these co-ops were a way for farmers to get out from under the man and the monopoly railroads and the monopoly farm implements sales, the monopoly seed sales, the whole set of monopolies that were crushing them. And these cooperatives started to spread, and these farm chapters started to spread. And they grew and grew, and there were. And what happened was an identity was created through the co-ops. People started to see themselves as populist. These were populist co-ops, and it transcended their other identities. Even black farmers at great peril to themselves, because this was Reconstruction, just past Reconstruction, where the white planter class was starting to reassert their power, but before Jim Crow actually set in, black farmers actually joined in this movement as well, although many suffered the consequences. That shared movement was very powerful. The next step that happened, though, and this is where it got interesting, is in order for those co-ops to survive, mm-hmm. they needed credit. And of course, none of the banks, none of the merchants would give them any credit because they saw them as competition. And Wall Street, of course, was not going to give them any credit. So the populace then came up with an alternative system to Wall Street's control of the money supply. They came up with this thing called the sub-treasury system, which basically allowed farmers to put their crops into federal warehouses and get in exchange paper currency that they could use, credit.
So the federal government had to be involved for this to work.
Absolutely. They wanted the federal government to supplant Wall Street, but they wanted it basically to be democratically controlled. They came up with a democratically controlled alternative to Wall Street. That was the beauty of it. And then this is the second thing they did. They then took this idea through a series of 4,000 lecturers, people that basically served the National Farmers Alliance and went out to their county chapters, of which there were tens and thousands of county chapters all through the South and Midwest. And they had discussions with the rank and file about the sub-treasury system, got ideas, went back to the leadership, back and forth and back and forth. But they educated these millions of people about the meaning of populism. And it worked. They actually put together a remarkable movement, and they challenged for power in basically 1892 and 96 and lost, but they still got a huge number of votes, and they made an enormous difference in the South.
So they ran candidates, actually?
State, local, and national level, eventually, as their own party.
Oh, okay.
And then on a national level, they fused with the Democrats, and there was a kind of coup d'etat that caused that, which wasn't good. William Jennings Bryan was not a populist. Free silver was not a populist idea either. That was something brought from the Democrats, and then but they were arguing against both parties, that both parties were controlled by big business, which was the truth.
So they had to make a move. They fused. Well, the magic phrase seems to be here that's sticking out for me is they fused with the Democratic Party, and the next thing you say after that,
that was their downfall. That killed them.
So what?
That wiped them out.
So how do we translate
that? The rank and file got discouraged. Well, I don't think the lesson to be learned here is about their political strategy at the end. I think the lesson to be learned is how you build a movement that could possibly even contend with political power. First, they had an idea. They had this mass common experience, which we don't have right now. And secondly, they had this mass educational system, which we don't have, but we could create. And thirdly, they had an idea, which I think we also could create, about how to democratize Wall Street. A little reform of Wall Street doesn't mean diddly. Mm-hmm. We need a massive overhaul. Those six big banks have got to become public utilities. But they cannot be run for private gain anymore.
But in this,
we'll be ruined.
But in this, but that's all quite clear. And in fact, it's happening as fast as a freight train headed towards us. But in those days, from what you're saying here, and from the thing you just recounted, they found a way around all this. They had their own system with the federal government. That's not going to happen right now, right? Especially since the federal government is so sewed up, you know.
Yeah, but the demands that we need now have to be demands that can't be backdoored, compromised away by the Democrats and Republicans. We need something that speaks to our genuine desire for a democratic country. There can be no democracy in this country any longer with Wall Street running wild. And just holding them back a little bit is not going to do it. It has to be completely restructured. The big banks have to be broken into smithereens. There has to be public – they have to be totally changed how they do business.
But the only force, the only power that's capable of doing this, since people can't walk into every bank and take it over, the only force that's capable of that is a wholly owned force of the banks. So where are we with this?
Well, but that wholly owned force public power can change when there's a mass movement to change it. Look, before the civil rights movement, the federal government, was also in the pocket. Look, the seniority committee, the racist Southern senators controlled Congress. You know, the government was a power that basically turned their back after Reconstruction, turned their back on black rights in the South, ignored the 14th and 15th Amendments, totally allowed people to be disenfranchised. The federal and then Woodrow Wilson institutionalized segregation on the federal level,
mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until World War II that any of that changed, but it changed. So the federal government can go from being total racist oppressors to actually by the 60s they were the forces that were trying to prevent the South from sending troops in. Federal government sent in troops like Reconstruction again to defend black rights in the South.
Now they did that
so
because
that
they
was
were
unheard of.
They did that because they were good-hearted or because their hearts in right
no, they
place.
They were
forced to by
public sentiment.
Okay, so here we are.
Yeah,
now.
So building a movement is the key. Look, the black civil rights movement was so powerful by the 1960s or even earlier that the United States could not wage a civil war, could not wage the Cold War and allow black rights to be trampled on, to have, dogs, gnarl protesters in the South on TV.
Mm-hmm.
It was, they had to act. Well, it's not possible for the federal government to continually – they can only be in the pockets of Wall Street if there's no countervailing force. If there's a countervailing force and that was strong enough to really pressure our system from the outside, then change becomes possible, only then.
Well, so obviously right now there is a tremendous and probably building countervailing sentiment on a basic gut level running through the whole country. I exempt for the moment the loony tea partiers and the all of those people, because although they are part of the 99% and it should be part of this movement, they are distorted by I don't know what, false news, moral values, whatever it is they call this stuff. But they should be included because they're all victims the same way we are, as bad as we all are. So the sentiment is here. The will, the heart's in the right place. The brain's in the right place. What is the next practical couple of steps? Because now they've evicted everybody, or they're in the process of evicting everybody from these actual spaces. Is there an Occupy movement without occupations?
Well, I think the question we have to ask is this: What do the rest of us do? What are the structures that are needed for the rest of us to participate in something that looks like, that adds to the Occupy Wall Street movement?
Yeah,
how do we begin? Okay, so yeah. I have a couple ideas.
Okay.
I wouldn't ask the question unless I had a couple of ideas.
I didn't think so. Okay.
Okay. One of the nice things that the Occupy Wall Street movement, by the way, I always say Occupy Wall Street. I never just say Occupy or OWS because the Wall Street is so key. But anyway, one of the things that they taught us was horizontal organizations are kind of cool because they allow for a lot of things to happen in a hurry, and you don't need some sort of massive tectonic national organization to pull it off. What I'm hoping might catch on is something like this, something I call the 99% clubs. Any two or three of us can get together, form a 99% club with no charter, no nothing, and what we can do are a range of activities to highlight this battle. It could be we could be very aggressive and become directly involved with Occupy Wall Street and demonstrations and sit-downs or whatever. We could be aggressive in I know some people that are starting to work on stopping home foreclosures, mm-hmm. Helping people out by just showing up en masse. Or we could be less aggressive and more educational. We could be passing out leaflets about income distribution. We could be holding we could be a book club reading, educating ourselves. We could be showing up at banks and having, little informational actions out front, et cetera. There are a whole group of things we could do, and I'm sure the imagination of American people is great enough that there would be thousands of different things that would emerge. The trick is, could we set up in a hurry something like, 1,000, 10,000 Occupy, 99% clubs across the country? And that would be for the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
Old farts like me and you could meet to, meet in Greenwich Village, work up a few leaflets, and, I could write about it. You could put them on the radio, and we could all of a sudden feel like we were doing something together.
Mm-hmm.
We might even, if our legs are up for it, we might even, take a walk in the next demonstration together. But the point is, any group of people could set it up. Then, through Facebook, Twitter, emails, we could communicate with each other. And at some point, it might be worthwhile to have a national gathering. But first, we need to have an infrastructure in place that's creative and loose, but some place where we could start to work together.
And the farmers' co-ops back in the 1880s, 1890s?
Yeah,
and the farmers
primarily the 1880s.
Okay, and the farmers' co-ops, they started locally, the way you're talking about, and then ultimately they seemed to build over a couple of years or maybe a decade for all I know. They built into a national organization. So
are
we talking about the same thing here? Should there, would there be a national coordinating group?
At some point, there could be a national coordinating committee at some point, but not without the base.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't go to the national coordinating committee without a base. I don't want to get – I think the leaderless nature of this should persist for a while. But I'll tell you, it would get – if these clubs emerged, they would get noticed in a hurry. I mean, if they were real, they would get noticed in a hurry, and then they would be replicated because anybody could do it.
Correspondence to what the Tea Party did in successfully taking over a political party, or are we talking about a different situation here?
A different situation, and something I think I would urge us to, we have to do the hard work first. The
mm-hmm.
next piece of the hard work that goes with this is I think we should recreate that educational system.
Hmm.
I think it's really important to develop a network where the real story of what went on economically gets told without being filtered through the major media. I think we need direct education of everyday folks all over the place. I know that you would not. I've been doing kind of since 2009, I've been doing workshops, all over the country on the economy,
mm-hmm.
and I've yet to find anybody resistant to understanding kind of the real facts and figures of what went down.
Right.
And I don't think there's any place in the country where I would get run out of town by telling this story. So the thing is, I can only tell the story, in a book that has, a little bit of circulation, and then personally that doesn't have much circulation at all. But we need, 1,000 people that are doing this.
If it was in Manhattan, it would be there's a club every 20, 30 blocks, something like that.
And then there'd be educators all over the place that mm-hmm. would service those clubs, but also be going to, local meetings, going to showing up at PTAs and, high schools and, having organizing teach-ins at the colleges. There's a whole piece of education that has to take place. There has to be a common narrative. We need to have a common understanding of how Wall Street took us down.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Les Leopold, and we're talking about the next step for Occupy, how it could become an actual force to change the actual government to change Wall Street, because this government is basically serving Wall Street. And Les is the author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. So here's the segue, right? I get... incensed, carried away more all the time, if it's possible to believe that, since you've heard me over there. You know, I have a blood, you know, count meter on my... But, you know, the whole idea of, and I'm getting a lot of angry, actually, a lot of upset emails from people who classify themselves as Democrats, liberals, progressive, whatever, and I'm talking about that the vote is completely wasted. If you vote for Obama, you're voting for Wall Street. If you vote for, it doesn't matter, fill in the blank of the clown show on the other side, you're voting for Wall Street. Yes, but he could point, but the president appoints a Supreme Court justice, yes this, yes that. I'm getting emails telling me I'm irresponsible to tell people. Now, I'm not telling people on the radio, don't vote. That's up to everybody else. I'm not influencing people. I'm just saying that I would never vote again for a Democrat or a Republican. I'm going to be voting for third-party candidates. I'm just searching for some good ones, and I have some leads already. But, and I'll be putting them on the air. But the segue is this. Here we have this outside movement, which basically, I think most of us agree, should remain an outside movement, right? But we can fend off the unions trying to co-opt us in the Democratic Party because they're so ham-handed and it's so obvious. However, the elections still happen. 2012 will come. People will have to go and vote. And would you go so far as I do to say that it's a waste of your vote to vote for any member of either of these two parties, for Senate, for the House, for the President, a waste of time?
Well, look, it's impossible for me to go as far as you do on virtually any of these issues. So
yeah.
I have to come at it my own way.
Okay.
I think we have to broaden the time horizon here. Assumption number one, preposition number one, is it's going to take an enormous struggle to democratize Wall Street. I'm talking about a decade at least. And we have to be prepared to work on this for a long period of time, or we are going to lose. That, I promise you, these guys are not going to give up in the next 6 months. So the elections that take place while we're building are not relevant to this struggle. I personally would rather see a Democrat than a Republican. I don't have a problem with that.
While we're struggling,
I'm not
in this
excited about it.
It
does nothing. It doesn't do anything towards building the struggle that I'm talking about. Both parties will continue to let Wall Street rule on a whole bunch of littler issues or other issues. I prefer, you know, the Republicans are so bad that I prefer the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no illusions that they're going to attack Wall Street. So we still need to build. I don't think we should conflate movement building and going into the Democratic Party. And that's what, voting for the Democrats, that's what I was trying to get across in this article. There are two completely different things.
So
Lakoff was saying we should occupy the Democratic Party. He's nuts. He has no idea what will happen if he does that.
Did you want to rephrase that? I mean, you know, George is nuts?
The whole point that somehow that we are in a position to barge in and take over the Democratic Party is ludicrous. It is not going to happen in the short run. We're too weak. We're too scattered. We're too disorganized. We don't know what we want yet.
And we don't have the corporate money to back us like they did.
Well, also, again, the Tea Party had an easier story. They just hate government. That's all.
Well, also, they did have a lot of hidden corporate money and more all the time.
Yeah, no, they had all that going.
Yeah.
But we don't have a sense of ourselves yet.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not going to take over the Democratic Party and turn it into a people's party, which is what they thought they might be able to do in 1896. We're not going to do that. We have to first build our populist movement, and unless we do build a vibrant movement, we don't have a chance of success. So I separate the two questions. There's a movement building question, and then there's the Tweedledee Tweedledum elections that are going to take place for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't get excited about that. I mean, I think the American people aren't going to get excited about it. They will hold their nose and vote for the Democrats. Or they may, just decide to vote the Republicans out or whatever they're going to do. But if they don't have any illusion that it's going to change the Wall Street game, I think that part of popular education is both parties have educated the American people about that fact. So what do we do about that fact? That's still, to me, the primary issue on the table.
Send
them my way. The people that are giving you grief, I'll take care of them. I'll explain that we're talking about two different things.
I'll forward all the emails to you. You can handle it. Right?
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, so let me just remind people, if they wanted to call and chime in on this issue and give us your 2 cents, which is probably now worth, what, 1 cent? It's 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888, and tweets are at PRN_radio. Don't forget to check out the archives of Occupied Territory on PRN.FM, and you can go to our Facebook page. So anybody who wants to call, here's your chance to do it. Meanwhile, so these two things exist side by side. We have this election coming up, and I tuned back in after, it was years, when Bush got reelected, I stopped watching the media very much, and then in 2008, Obama came on, and, I watched for a little while, and there was triumphalism, and then everybody got incredibly angry in every way, with his Justice Department, his Treasury Department, and his bland attitude and his passivity. So then I gave it up for a while. Now I'm tuning in again because I get interested in the clown show. You know what I mean? This, what is it, the 15 debates already or something? You know, it was funny. It was interesting and occasionally horrifying to watch these Republicans do whatever it is that they do. And then I start looking at, because one of the points you mentioned in your article is alternative media, right? Now, obviously, Wall Street and corporations that are backed by Wall Street own, fewer and fewer corporations own most of the media now. So where you get your information? Well, thank God there is an Internet, and there are alternet.org, literally alternet.org, and other sites. There's other radio stations, but still very much in the minority. But the media is important here, right? I mean,
I think we've made overestimated its impact and underestimated what we can do if we build a movement. Let me take you back to the populace and then jump up to Occupy Wall Street.
We do have one call,
Okay, so I won't be long here.
Yeah.
There were about 100 journals that helped push the populist cause. Independent journals ran on a shoestring. Remind me very much of your show and websites and stuff like that. So they existed then, they existed now. I think we can do that. When we start doing dramatic work, then the media were tripping over themselves to cover it. I mean, I was down at Zuccotti Park, and there were so many media people there, they were interviewing each other. Mm-hmm. It was remarkable. So we can get the story out if we're doing something. If we set up these 99% clubs and they take off around the country, they'll get covered. And then our alternative media will be there. But the key in the populist thing was not the media. It was the educational system, the lecturers, because that was more give and take, just like the caller. Mm-hmm. This will be more give and take, and I step back for the caller.
Beautifully done. So when is your radio show starting?
You're teaching me.
No, when is your radio show?
I don't need one. I've got you.
No. You should be on here. You should have a show. Seriously, you should. I'm going to look into it for you. So who do we have? Okay, John, third-party candidacy. Go ahead.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, you're on.
Hi.
Hello, Michael. I enjoy your show. I just want to mention about third-party candidacies. We do have a third-party candidate running who's actually leading in the Ohio polls at the moment. His name is Ron Paul. He started out as a libertarian candidate, and now he's running ahead.
Hold on a second. You're confusing me. Ron Paul is running as a Republican, right?
Yeah, I know. No, but he started out as a third-party candidate.
Yeah, but he's not a third-party candidate now.
No. He's
okay,
actually, he's going to restart the Constitution. I don't think we can go further, because right now the Constitution is crumbling underneath us. We have habeas corpus going down the drain, and starting off all these wars, and none of these other candidates, Democrats included, are going to do anything about the corporatists or anything. But Ron Paul. Ron Paul is the only one who's not a corporatist.
All right, thank you. Les?
Look, of the Republicans, Ron Paul is certainly the most interesting, because he's such an oddball, and his libertarian streak is endearing. Do I think he's got the guts to take on Wall Street? Well, I look at what his son's putting forward, and it's a Wall Street program to the core. So I'm a little skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
His attack on fiat money. I mean, that would basically turn over the money supply back to Wall Street entirely.
Well, if he wants to eliminate all government control of everything, then you're eliminating control of Wall Street, so they maintain their power. Right.
They won't just maintain their power. They'll have all the power.
Right.
Decontrol them entirely. They'll have more domination of the economy. So I think he's living in a world that just doesn't match the current reality. We need countervailing power.
Mm-hmm.
I look forward to Ron Paul supporting our movement as opposed to the other way around.
All right.
But we had one listener. That's a really good.
The internet is it's strange. It's different than when you're on Sirius on XM.
So we're not on a radio station. We're on the internet.
We're on a radio station which is on the internet. And what I've been told is that there's a good number of listeners, but it's nothing like the national audience for a series or something like that. And then what happens is you get a multiple of something like 10 to 20 times the downloads later on. That's how the show gets listened to, which is why I spend a lot of time talking to the guests, because people listen to it in their silos, more or less. You know what I mean? So the live show is not the same, if that makes any sense. So.
No, it does. It does. I guess I look forward to getting back on the other one.
Yes, absolutely, because then you'll get lots of people calling you up and telling you you're a socialist and you hate Christ and everything else, because that's the part I like. Let me read one last thing to you here. Obviously we had our whole discussion about what we can do to move forward here, but here's something from this is a press release that was sent out by Occupy Albany, and I'm hooked into all these places now. And it says, as you know, our permit from the city of Albany is to remain in the park expires on Thursday. That's tomorrow. They had a permit. The city has not been willing to tell us what they will do when the permit expires, but we have told them that we intend to stay in the park through the winter, although the exact manifestation of presence is still being determined on our end. While we will be leasing an indoor office and teaching space, many believe that the remaining in the park makes an important political statement. And here, this is the thing. The park is not only a piece of public property that we, the public, have a right to use, but our occupation is also an ongoing objection to the policies of the 1% that affects us all. But here's the sentence, and we only have a couple of minutes left. Every time someone passes by the encampment, they recognize it as resistance to these policies. Obviously, you know, the NAACP has offices, so does the Democratic Party. But what makes this different right now is people are out there, and they are visible all over the place all the time. Without that, what? You know.
That's incredibly important. And notice what they said. It's visible statement that reminds people, dramatizes the 1% and the 99%. Again, this is about Occupy Wall Street, about the financial elites that are basically towering over us. And we need other manifestations of that. That's why I'm advocating these 99% clubs. We need something in addition to the visible encampment,
mm-hmm.
so that the rest of us can show our displeasure. And supposed to, I mean, you said it before. Let me borrow Richard Nixon's phrase. There is a silent majority out there that detests what's going on Wall Street. And that silent majority needs expression. And I think it would participate in these clubs should these clubs ever emerge. Hey, if not the clubs, something else will emerge.
Sure.
I'm just throwing that out to stimulate the discussion.
All right, we're at the end. Everything must end, but this is just the beginning. So, Les Leopold, thank you very much. And then we'll set up sometime in January, February, our next show on Sirius XM, right?
Whatever, and happy holidays to you and yours.
Merry Christmas and happy Hanukkah to you all at once.
Happy Hanukkah. Right.
That's how I get around it. I say them both, you see. So, okay.
Very good.
All right, no war on Christmas here, pal.
Not here either. Good.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, take care of yourself.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.
Okay, we'll end with a quote here. Any people anywhere being inclined and having the power have the right to rise up and shake off the existing government and form a new one that suits them better. This is a most valuable, a most sacred right, a right which we hope and believe is to liberate the world. That's Abraham Lincoln. It's time for us to do that.